Fellow Mentors, welcome to our podcast series, Mentorships in Education, brought to you by Just Education at justeducationfirst.com. I am your host, Judy Epstein. I am very excited about the wide range of experts who have volunteered to give up their time and expertise. They will share their innovative ideas, their exciting perspectives, their rich resources, and their research with us. Please continue to delve into these topics on their websites and with your legal counsel, healthcare provider, and education professional. Our guests will have information that will be relevant to mentors supporting struggling students, parents, teachers, administrators, legal support, and health professionals. We will address all levels of education with issues that affect academic performance. Our goal is to open discussions and introduce a variety of approaches to those searching for information in a free venue. So, mentors, let me introduce our guests for today. Welcome, mentors, to the Judge Education First podcast, Mentorship in Education. Literacy is a very hot topic right now in our country, and we hope to explore its impacts on how pervasive it is and how we can address it. Today, we're privileged to have with us David Bolton. Thank you, David, for agreeing to be a guest on Mentorship in Education and for all of the time that you've given to me in helping to prepare for this. I very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Judith. It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. I want to tell our listeners a little bit about you because you have such an impressive resume. I was a little daunted when I read it. And I want people to further explore what it is that you have done, what you have accomplished by going to your website at learningstewards.org, and that's Stewards with an S.org. To read more about you and your research and your products and your programs that you've developed, as well as the accolades that you've received from many quarters of education. David is an authority on the acquisition of language and the process involved in learning to read. He is president of Learning Stewards, director of Children of the Code Project. You are a speaker, a technologist, a documentary producer, a blogger, and a writer. My gosh. You are a noted authority on language acquisition, as I said, and reading development. You oversee Magic Ladder for struggling readers, which we're going to get into later. And you developed some software called Electronic Campus for Apple Computer. You've won numerous awards, one of which is from the Smithsonian Award for innovation, and your company was recognized as one of the top companies by Upside Magazine. I'm out of breath.
That was quite a while ago, that one. Yes.
It doesn't make any difference how long ago it was. It's just quite a statement to be able to say, you know, about you and your accomplishments. And I want to tell our mentors that there's so much more that you have to share. And again, I would encourage them to go to your website and read more about what the things you have done. David, I was so intrigued when we spoke on the phone a while ago. Perhaps you'd be willing to start sharing with some of our mentors the startling data that you shared with me related to literacy and kids and adults, and so that we have a better understanding, a grasp of this, how pervasive this problem is?
Sure. Well, as of 2017 NAEP, which is the nation's most authoritative educational science source, in which the kind of report cards for sample data brought from districts around the country are aggregated into patterns. It's clear that, according to that source anyway, which most of the state leaders, state assessment leaders, think to be the most authoritative source, 65% of the fourth graders and eighth graders in this country, across the board, all races, all SES groups, everything, are below proficiency with reading.
Oh my goodness.
It's important to understand what we mean by proficiency, right? So proficiency means that you can read at a level that the kind of brain work of reading is transparent to the mind work of learning through reading at the grade level you're in. So when you're a proficient reader in the fourth grade, that means that reading is just completely transparent to learning at with fourth grade texts, right? And if you're below that, what that means is that reading, your difficulty with reading, is making learning through writing in your grade level harder. So in that sense, 65% of all the fourth graders and all the eighth graders, and we don't have data on the 12th graders, but it's pretty much the same from the older data that we do have, are chronically underwater. By chronically, what I mean is that you can go back from the very beginning of their school experience all the way throughout their whole arc in school, and they are below proficiency with reading, meaning reading is a obscuring, exacerbating overlay to the challenge of learning and throughout their entire educational experience. Now, that's the aggregate of all fourth graders. If you disaggregate that to look at Black Hispanic children, they're the fourth grade Black children, 80% below proficiency. Hispanic, 77%. In eighth grade, it's actually a little worse. Right. So we're talking about, in any case, the majority of our kids are chronically not good enough at reading, according to our assessment systems. That's their experience throughout school. And so this leads to lots of different things. I'll let you take the, you know, take us to the next step. But that's an important background for understanding the gravity of the problem.
No, well, I want you to develop that. But I just have one other question.
Sure.
I'm wondering if. In the aggregate, if one of the issues that we're having with kids not being able to learn to read is the process or the pedagogy that's going on in the class that is perhaps too narrow for some kids to be able to adapt.
Yeah, getting into why the underlying reasons behind the improficiency is really complicated and multifaceted.
Okay. Do you want to wait and get into that later, maybe, or?
I would say that in my worldview, the number one reason we have so many improficient readers has to do with the way we think about learning. The way that education thinks about learning, the way that researchers think about learning, the way that teachers think about learning, the way that students think about learning, and the way that the entire reading instruction system thinks about learning. So I think the underlying problem with reading is really an underlying problem with learning. But before we go to that, I think that probably the important point to make relative to the understanding the scope of what's at stake, right? When we think about this many kids being improficient with reading, you know, there's a consequence to that. And there's an obvious consequence in terms of their lack of access to learning from written materials in their grade level. That's pretty obvious. What's less obvious is the collateral damage, because what that means, and you can only try to, I ask everybody who's listening to kind of imagine that. Imagine day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, having to do something you cannot avoid, that you know is super important to your future in life, and that you can't seem to get better at. You can't seem to get good enough at, right? So how can you not develop a sense that you're not that good at learning?
I know where you're going with this because I did read some of the things that you wrote. And I just want to wait a little bit before we start throwing some of those terms around. I guess one of the questions I have for you is I have a feeling that I did a lot of research in education before you were even thinking about it. I think I'm significantly older than you are. And a lot of the data that I was exposed to were some of the traditional educators or researchers at the time, you know, like Piaget and Vygotsky and, and, you know, and they were considered to be the apex of approaches to education, and everybody was trying to gear their teaching to what, you know, what these people said was the right way to do it. And I guess what I'm wondering is if you think, if you had an aha moment, I guess, if you had an aha moment at some point when you were looking at some of these older, you know, this compilation of older research and your experiences, and if you in some way had an aha moment that sent you in a different direction.
Yeah, a couple of them. probably the, you know, the two biggest things for me was, first of all, I wasn't formally trained in education and educational psychology or educational neuroscience. My education was in quantum physics as it related to semiconductors and other things. And so when I came into this domain, I was curious and interested. And I was constantly running up into, you know, documents and publications in which the way that the material was presented kind of assumed that somebody had came into that sphere or came into that domain of knowledge and learning on a more traditional track. And so it used jargon and vocabulary that was idiosyncratic and assumed certain background conceptual knowledge and what have you. And I realized in the course of all of that, that even though I didn't have the kind of formal pre-training that went along with those deeper studies, that was a representational surface. How can I best put this? I guess the takeaway for me was I came to realize that I could learn anything if who or what I was learning from could meet me on the edge of my learning with what it is I needed to stay in it.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. You ought to and write that down. I didn't see that in your reading, and I like it.
It's in the older stuff in my early days. But that was a really key insight for me, and it wasn't about me. This was about everybody. And I came to realize that the way education functions and the way that books are published and documentaries are made and everything else is it's really not designed to have that kind of responsiveness. It's designed to be more of a product, projector, push, provide, but not dance on the edge that I'm describing. And I came to realize that I could, like I said, I could learn anything if who or what I was learning from could meet me on the edge of my learning with what I needed to stay in it. And I came to believe so could everybody. Now, by that, I don't mean that there aren't 1 or 2% of the population with neurobiologically innate differences in their learning and / wiring that might make it difficult for them. But for the vast majority of humanity, any one of us could learn anything if we were interested in it and if who or what we were learning from could meet us with what we needed to stay in it. And it seemed to me, and it still seems to me, socially, negligently, borderline criminal that our world doesn't support that.
Wow. Okay. Can you...
All right.
I want you to elaborate a little on that. An example or something that you've come across.
Well, probably the best example to me is the difference between natural and artificial learning. That's where it plays out the best and the easiest to get your hands around. If you watch a little baby as they, you know, over, and I have spent a lot of time with little babies, a couple things come up. Number one, how anybody could think that human beings are no good until they're externally saved by some mechanism suggests that they've never actually been in any kind of loving contact with a human infant. I mean, they're just brilliant, off-scale, brilliant, bright, present, learning their way beings until they learn otherwise. And in the natural order of things, humans learn by differentiating their extension on the real-time living edge of right now. So You know, if you pay attention to a baby, whether they're learning to manipulate a spoon to get a food in their mouth, or they're toddler and they're starting to walk and they're learning to sense themselves fall in ever more differentiated ways so that they can move so as to not fall. They're not running some kind of mechanical computer program like thing about how to walk, take this step, move this hip, you know, they're gravity dancing.
Right.
They're dancing so as to not fall, and their capacity to not fall is connected to their ability to sense when they are falling.
Right. And no one's yelling at them and saying, do this, do that. This is right. That's wrong.
Yeah. There's no, it's an internal inside out learning in which they are getting feedback at real time on the edge of what they're doing. And the same is true for learning to speak and make intelligible speech sounds. And the same is true for learning to manipulate a toy or a small object, or to dance, to ride a bike, to do so many things, to emotionally negotiate with parents and siblings. All these things are living on the edge of right now kind of learning. And humans just excel at that.
I'm hearing some of the concepts from you that I know that you have written about. And one of them is the psychological well-being of someone who is learning to read, a child who is learning to walk and who is having success and who is struggling, and they're accomplishing their goal. They fall, they get up, they fall, they get up, and they feel good about themselves. They're very proud of themselves. When they do that.
Very few toddlers give up on walking because of their falls.
They give up on it?
No, or they don't.
No, don't.
How many toddlers have you known that said, well, you know what, this is tough, I'm going to quit?
Right.
They don't do that, right?
No, but if someone was yelling directions at them and trying to get them to put their feet in a certain position and their arms in a certain position and saying, you have to walk this way, that might be disconcerting to the learning process.
Yeah, if it could be disruptive to their calibrated sense of their own internally generated feedback, right? It would corrupt their attention to what it is they're sensing that is the core of their ability to learn to walk.
So you've thrown around some terms, which I know I've read about, you know, decades ago. These were touched upon, certainly shame was touched upon years ago. I don't remember the author that wrote a book on shame, but it was a topic years ago. And You kind of equate that idea of being shameful, of not being able to learn what it is that everybody else finds so easy to learn. And you bring that back to the code, and you talk about the overwhelming ambiguity in the code that is giving some people difficulty in learning to read. Is that a good place to pick that up?
Sure. It's a bit of a jump from where we were, but I think it's,
okay.
That's fine. I kind of like that. In fact, I've written articles that I use the word jump between spots on. Let's leave the natural world, which we just went through, and then talk about the artificial world, which is what we're talking. When we talk about reading, we're talking about an unnaturally confusing brain processing challenge, right? It's different than anything that happens in nature. Is it different than anything that humans ever did in nature or ever did at all until just a few hundred years ago?
Right. So you make a correlation, though, to that artificial prompting that's going on and trying to direct what could be the learning to walk process, and equate that to the artificial learning process in learning to read?
Only partially. Okay. And because it's not, ultimately, the learning to read thing happens in the intimacy of one's mind, right?
Okay.
So even though there may be a teacher or a parent or somebody saying you should do this or you should do that, the real you know, devil that's in the details with reading is happening at an incredibly fast rate. So, for example, if you take a word like let's start with sound. Take a word like bad and dad, or cat and hat. Right? You can hear the difference between those words. You immediately recognize them. But if you were to listen, if you were to look at a sine wave or a temporal profile of those words, you realize that it's just a fraction of a second that your brain is having to pay attention to sound in order to know that I just said bad instead of dad, or to know that I said hat instead of bat. Okay. It's a fraction of a second, right? So in order for reading to produce an internal experience of language that's anything like the experience of language we're used to, which is to say moving words at a flow rate kind of like we talk and listen to, then the code has to be processed into word recognition at a faster rate than we can really think about. So the problem is not just external instructions from others that are confusing us, but the fact that we're talking about having to process an artificial, a technology. I mean, the code is a human-invented, adult-invented technological device.
So it's almost an artificial programming of our brain.
Absolutely. That's where the name Children of the Code comes from, right?
Okay.
In some sense, it is the greatest invention in the history of history, right? Next to speech, you could say there was speech, right? In the beginning was the word. Human beings started using language, you know, some period of time, and boom, that creates one big explosion in human intelligence and in human activity and performance and capability and collaboration and all of that. And then came writing. And writing became this way in which we could take speech and stop it in front of our minds and be able to record it and manipulate it and do things with it. And then ultimately, writing changed speech so that we talk more like the writing systems have changed and transformed what speech does. So this invention, this technological capacity for processing language through written symbols is artificial. It's completely artificial. And in order to do it, yes, to answer your question, our brain has to function like a machine. Mm-hmm. And it is the problem of getting our brains to function reliably, efficiently, automatically like a machine that is the obstacle course wall of education.
So we learn to talk what you would say is a natural process of learning to speak, but our reading is an artificial learning to speak. There isn't, we can't equate, we can't transfer what we've learned from learning to talk to learning to read.
No, the processing, we certainly can at the level that reading gets to a point where word recognition and reading is as easy as word recognition and listening, they're the same business. Then they're just language, right? Okay. So it's only at the point of getting from the symbols to word recognition that reading is its unique artificial thing.
So, again, I go back to my basis of education a long time ago, and I remember that Vygotsky used to say that there was a zone of proximal development when kids were ready to do certain things. Do you believe that with this? Is this something that you would apply to reading?
Well, if back to your question, I'll answer that in a parallel way and connect it to a question you asked earlier relative to why are so many kids improficient?
Right.
And I would say that in line with Vygotsky's zone, that yes, in order to take off in reading, there's three core things. One, there has to be a level of readiness, a readiness that has to do with vocabulary, phonemic differentiation in the soundscape, the emotional resilience and frustration tolerance to work through the confusion, right? So there has to be a readiness to take on the challenge. And if we try to get kids that aren't ready to take on the challenge, the likelihood of them being successful is much less And the consequence of that will be the development of shame in relation to it, which will then become an obstacle to them doing it. So there's a there is a readiness. Now, that readiness comes from early life learning trajectories, right? So children, for example, that come from taciturn households or households in which they are not encouraged to take mental risks. Right?
Right.
And so, or that they are otherwise ashamed of themselves for not feeling smart, right? Any number of things can cause them to be behind the curve, and most kids are.
So do you encourage parents then when they are, when their children are young, to help prepare them for learning to read as well as other challenges that they're going to face? Do you encourage them to allow their children to make mistakes, to investigate, to be curious? What advice would you give
my number them? My number one thing for parents is that the most important thing to recognize as a parent is that your number one job is to steward the healthiness of your children's learning at all times, as an academic exercise, at all times, in every situation. There is never one microsecond that the child is not learning. They may not be learning what we want. They may not be learning it well. They may be learning it in a way that's going to be a self-sabotage, but always learning. And the parent's job is to create the conditions in which the child is learning in the most healthy possible way, most adaptive possible way.
And give me some specifics that parents should be doing to steward healthy learning, because there are parents that have a very different perspective of what that means.
Right, right. But yes. Well, first of all, there's two things that connect to this. One is the most important thing to do is to make sure that you are contextualizing your child's difficulties in a way that minimizes them shaming out.
Oh, I like that.
Right? Mm-hmm. To the extent that they feel at fault for difficulties, especially difficulties having to do with artificial learning challenges. But across the board, the biggest danger to the health of our learning is becoming ashamed of our learning. And that's happening en masse in our population.
Can you talk a little bit about Children of the Code? Is that
Children of the Code is an outgrowth of the conversation we've been having about the necessity of stewarding the health of our children's learning. Is my central mission, right? And recognizing that if you were to look at all the various things that threaten the learning health of children, there's no single thing that threatens the learning health of children more than the challenge of learning to read.
And so
that's what led to Children of the Code. And Children of the Code was basically a documentary project that went on from 2002 to 2010 or so. And it's actually still alive and going. It's not over. It's just not as vital and fresh and new. But it still contains a library of over 1,000 hours of conversations like this one with over 100 scientists and scholars and world-leading authorities on one dimension or another related to understanding the challenge of learning to read.
So, if some of our listeners wanted to access some of those, would they do that on Learning Stewards?
Learning Stewards has a gateway to Children of the Code, but Children of the Code is its own website.
Okay.
It's all one string, childrenofthecode.org. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
once you go there, there's 60-something full-length interviews, about 5,000 or 6,000 paper page equivalents of in-depth indexed interviews with the who's who of reading science and scholars. And there's also 134 video segments dealing with every different component from the early stages of readiness, innate, learning differences, genes, to the emotions and cognition, to language exposure as children, to phonemic differentiation, aspects of the brain challenge, how the brain disambiguates the code, a very deep, long conversation about reading shame, how shame works, why it works, what it does, what its long-term effects are, a history of the code from the beginnings of scratching on bones to the emergence of the writing of the English system and why it's so mangled and messy.
One of the reasons that this idea of shame attracted me to your research was that I had a difficult time in elementary school and was made to feel inferior and dumb and not able to participate in many of the activities that were going on at the level that I should have been able to. I ended up repeating a grade in sixth grade, stumbled through seventh and eighth grade, and got into high school and found an English teacher who was willing to take some time with me. And that teacher made me feel so good about the things I could do well, which was write. She said I was a great writer, and it gave me, and didn't say, but you're not going to be able to do this because, she said, how about if we try putting your writing on a template? Now, this was when templates were never heard of, but she drew one for me. And she created a process for me to learn to organize my thoughts and my thinking so that I went on to do very well, both in high school and later in college and later in graduate school. And if it wasn't for her taking the time to give me some guidance and make me feel good about the one thing that I could do really well, she got me over that idea of shame. So when you talk about shame, I can see how that it would be a devastating effect on kids.
Yeah, I would say to you that this represented an inflection or turning point in your confidence trumping your shame, so to speak. But there's no such thing as being without shame, right? I mean, shame is a bioaffective component. Just like if you stub your toe, you feel a pain, you know, in your body.
Right.
If you fail to do something that you think is important, right, you're going to feel shame, right? If it's not important, you're not going to feel shame. But shame is a biological learning prompt. It causes us to pay attention in an uncomfortable way to something we're doing. And on the one hand, we wouldn't learn so good without it. We couldn't learn at all.
Right. But
once that becomes, think about it. They talk about body shaming. They talk about, smile shaming or people being ashamed to dance, right, or sing or whatever. Once we become ashamed of something, we want to avoid it because we don't want to feel, we want to avoid doing it. So, for example, one great illustration of this has to do with the great old question, what is it that most adults fear? And other than the fear of death or the fear of death of a loved one, the number one common public fear is public speaking.
Right.
So you slingshotted around your problem. But the reason for that is, I think, number one, it's not a fear of public speaking. It's a fear of shame.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And it has its roots in the kind of public speaking that we make little ones do in classrooms.
So, David, if our mentors go to Children of the Code and they're interested in a particular topic, they would be able to search.
So again, Children of the Code is an enormously rich library of resources. It's not a single 2-hour, 3-hour documentary kind of thing where you got to watch it all linearly and kind of go with the whole flow. It's full of individual embeddable molecules. All the videos are free. You can watch them. You can stick them in your share them with kids. There's a number of folks around the country that use the shame video of kids talking about how they feel about reading to help other kids feel more relaxed about it, for other kids not to feel so alone about it. Probably the most amazing thing in Children of the Code wasn't the conversations with the experts. I mean, I had the privilege of talking to neuroscientists and psychologists that are you know, they were state-of-the-art definers of our current understanding of reading.
I did go and listen to some of them, and they were amazing. I had to look up some of the terminology that they were using.
Right. But what was most amazing and what's most touching in all of this is the kids. The kids talking about what does it feel like? You know, the incredible, remember what I said about they're always learning?
Yes.
So these are kids that are learning how to avoid the teacher, how to avoid revealing their problem, willing to fail tests rather than ask for more time because it's taken them so long to read it. Watching the teacher as their body moves so that they can drop the pencil at just the time that the teacher's gaze is going to scan their way so that the teacher won't see them and call on them. You know, just on and on and on. The brilliant, adaptive, in the most warped sense,
right,
that goes on. Because we, and I come back to this, everybody listening, think about something that shames you. How many times have you said, wow, I feel really ashamed. Let me learn about that. Let me get.
I don't think I've ever done that.
Yeah, most of us, our kind of primitive instinct when we feel shame is to get away from whatever's causing that.
Right.
Right. So my big question that permeates all of my work is, if it's our nature to avoid shame, what happens to our learning in life if we become ashamed of learning?
That's a good question.
It sits at the core of everything for me. Because that's what's happening. We got a society that's learning disabled because they're growing up ashamed of their learning because us, this is why I said, remember early on, that the underlying problem for reading was really a problem about how we think about learning.
Right.
And this is where those things connect.
So from here, you went to develop Magic Ladder.
Right.
And how did you get from these to Magic Ladder?
Well, it's an interesting personal story that goes back 30 years. So let me start there, and I'll try to make this part quick. But
okay, I was going to ask you what your personal connection was, so that's great.
So my two kids dragged me to this. I was already working in learning science fields. I was working at Apple. I was, as you mentioned, I designed an electronic campus, the first virtual university that Apple made. And I was the CEO of a robotics company, and I was very interested in learning, but I'd always taken reading for granted. And then one day my 5-year-old son, who was my learning partner in a lot of my early learning journey into learning, comes home from school with a book in his hands, and he points at a word in the book, and he looks at me and he says, "Dad, it can't be that way." It can't be that way.
Wow.
He had grown up thinking, hey, I may not understand something, but whatever it is, it's understandable.
Right.
Right. Whether it was playing a Nintendo game or it was learning about other aspects of the world, he came to trust that even though he may not yet understand it, that it was understandable. It was intelligible. It was just a learning challenge for him to get to it.
You don't happen to remember the word, do you?
No, I don't. I don't. Okay. I wish I did. I wish I did. I have other stories from my daughter that are more recent and vivid. Anyway, his kindergarten teacher said to me that this was a kid who had a vocabulary of a 20-year-old. He was, his verbal dexterity was off scale. He was verbally brilliant kid. And so he was able to take me on a tour from a brilliant, verbally dexterous mind, 5-year-old's mind, into what the experience of learning to read was like. And he showed me, revealed to me, how bizarrely confused this thing is, the letters and sounds, the relationship between letters and sounds. It's just nuts.
Out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yeah. So at that time, what I did at the time was made a paper-based and a pencil-based kind of version of what later would become the Magic Ladder that you asked about. And basically, what occurred to me was that it was possible to, without changing an A to look like anything but an A. In other words, while keeping the character, the letter recognition features of each character, it was possible to change the visual appearance of a letter so that it would tell you which of its possible sounds it was actually sounding like in the word you were looking at. So for example, when a letter makes its letter name, we make it bolder. We made it bolder, made it stand out more. When a letter was silent, we made it grayer, right? When a letter was blended together, we made them touch together, right? So I just did a little things like this. And he got it. This was way back then. He got it, and he just took off with reading. And I shared it with a few teachers and educational colleagues, and they thought I was nuts. And I left it there.
I'm curious, why did they think it was nuts?
Because, and I'll come to that, there was a really world-famous linguist just before Chomsky, by the name of Hockett, William Hockett. And he said something that just nails this, which is that it's easier for people to change their religion than their writing system.
That is ingenious.
Yeah, and that's really what's at root, is that the writing system has this kind of near it's cultish religion like belief mechanisms associated with how it's welded and fused into us, you know.
What was his name again?
Hockett.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, 10 years go by, and now I have a 5-year-old daughter, and she's also struggling, but she has a different kind of struggle. It's not just a conceptual mess of the letter-sound relationships. She has an auditory memory processing deficit. And what that means is that she works out a word at great labor, and then one sentence later encounters the same word and has to work it out all over again because she can't remember it.
Right.
And with her, the cueing system that I mentioned earlier that helped my son helped her too. But she was dying. I could feel the shame. She felt so bad. And that led me to essentially pulling her out of school, homeschooling her through the reading thing, and beginning what would become the Children of the Code Project. The Children of the Code Project, by the time I got to it, was already informed by my understanding of shame because of my daughter and the letter sound confusion because of my son.
I thought it was the reverse. That's interesting.
No. What bothered me was is that I felt I had, even back then, I had a different way of looking at the letter sound problem and how to solve it. But nobody wanted to give it any attention. And the reason that nobody wanted to give it any attention was because, and this is what I came to that fired Children of the Code, is because they think they understand reading, but they don't. In other words, it is the certainty that we already understand reading and how to teach it. That is the problem.
That is the problem, right?
That is the problem. Right. So Children of the Code was born to create a body of evidence and an exercise environment that would support people that were willing to and interested in learning into what we know about reading rather than sticking to the belief systems.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done. Go.
No, I just wanted to say I went to the magic ladder to use it. And I had so much fun with that. I can see where kids would be captivated. You said earlier, you know, give kids a reason to learn.
Yeah.
Just using the technology on that program and being able to learn what each of the changes in the words mean would be an incentive to kids that I've taught, young kids that I've taught, because they're so, everything they do is technology. It would be just one more challenge for them to be able to be successful at learning how to do that. And I have to say, I was on that thing for a good half hour, if not more, reading, not so much because I was interested in the subject matter, but because I wanted to see what happened to all the letters when I kept moving it along.
Yeah, so basically, that's great. So that's a great takeoff to go into the magic letter. And the magic letter, basically, the better technical term for it is interactive orthography, right? Mm-hmm. Interactive orthography. And the logic is this. Everything about reading instruction in America and around the world in alphabetic orthographies is based on the notion that the word itself is an inert static object. So the reader's brain has to be trained in advance of encountering the word to have the kind of reflexive response to the confusions in the word that will allow them to recognize it before the whole, you know, train breaks down, right? The whole comprehensional train breaks down. Right. So everything about phonics and whole language and balanced literacy and every one of the other systems out there are basically abstract, offline. In other words, they're not helping somebody just in time and the flow of their learning to read. It's like a training camp where they're taking people offline of reading and running them through various kinds of abstract exercises and rules and what have you, so that later when they're actually on the live edge of reading, they'll have this stuff in the back of their head help them recognize words, right?
Yes.
Magic Ladder is 180 degrees out of phase with that. It says, we don't have to do any of that. If the kids can just touch a word and the word can help them learn to recognize it, the word can help them learn to understand it, and it can do it in a systematic way that generalizes to learning all words.
So, and that's what's fascinated me. As I said, I wasn't really interested in the subject matter, but it was the interaction of the technical flow of what was happening to the words that really mesmerized me and wanted me to be able to go to the next word and say, oh, now I understand it. Now I see what it's doing.
Right. Exactly.
To do that.
Yeah. So with the magic ladder, the idea is never blow off a word you don't know. Never blow off a word you don't recognize. Because what is that doing? That's teaching you to dull out to recognizing that. It's teaching you to guess. If you've ever worked with a fourth grader or older who's struggling with reading, their problem is no longer the initial letter sound confusion stuff. Their problem is that, first of all, they're shame averse and their emotional intelligence don't want to do it anymore, one. And two, that has led them to all kinds of guessing strategies, looking in pictures, looking in context, trying to guess the word from its surrounds rather than work the word from its letters.
Right. And there's a integration in the program of the visual and the auditory.
Right.
And for me, that was great because one I'm weaker at and one I'm stronger at, and the combination of the two made it was almost like a sweet candy. You know, it really encouraged me to continue.
There's a staged and scaffold design to it. So for example, A struggling reader encounters a word they can't recognize. So all they do is they touch it or click it if they've got a mouse, right? And as soon as they do, it pops up, and the word is exactly what they were looking at, except it's busted into smaller segments. So it's got smaller readable units for them to look at. And maybe that's all they need. If they do, they just go on. If they touch another button, off they go, and it's gone. It could be that maybe that isn't enough, and so then they click it again. If they click it again, then every letter that makes this letter name turns bold. Every letter that's silent comes gray. Every group that combines has a little dotted line underneath it, so that they get these staged scaffold layers of hints, so that we're not reading for them. We're stretching their mind into understanding how to make the letter sound connections that will make them good readers.
David, I'm curious, have kids who have cognitive challenges been able to use this program?
Yes, but that's anecdotal, not scientific. But yes, yeah, the kids that we've worked with across a variety of different spectrums of special ed and what have you have been beneficiaries of this. In addition to what I just described about these stages, once they come to the end of the stages, it actually does an animated sound out. So just like when we say to kids in school, sound out the word, and they go, that's their problem. Of course, how the heck are they supposed to sound it out? So this thing, after the hints it gives them, it actually, if they keep clicking, it will sound it out for them and then say it the way it would be normally spoken and heard, right?
Well,
so
it was fascinating.
This whole go ahead.
It was just fascinating. And I wonder if, is it being used as a tool to work with these kids in the schools at all?
There are schools in Kentucky that are using it. There are individual practitioners, parents, and teachers that are using it in non-institutional ways. We are in the process now of kind of scaling it up. The last stage of the interactive orthography really just started to coalesce last summer. And so it's been full blast in one school that we're in test with. And we are, you've got Dolby on your stereo, right?
Yes.
And it's on your TV set and it's on your Blu-ray player.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, right? And we want orthography to be like that. We want what we're doing to just be the way text works. Whenever it's on a phone or a tablet or a computer or a television set or anything that's electronic, if there's a word there, all you got to do is touch it to get any help you might need to be able to recognize it. Or, we didn't talk about this, there's also a button inside that little pop-up that opens up a complete a reference library for that word instantaneously. So a dictionary, synonyms, thesaurus, the etymological information, and translation, so that if you're coming from Spanish or Germany or China or whatever language you're coming from, you can see that word in your language.
So would you recommend to parents that this be something that they make available on a iPad or, whatever the different technology that they play with all the time available to them so that they can sit and play this almost like a game?
Yeah. In fact, there are games that we've built into. There's three parts to this at a technological level. One is that we have a code we can give a website provider. So for example, if you have a website yourself, and I know that you're building one or going to have one that houses all of this stuff, we can give you a code that it takes you 2 minutes to put in, and then every word on your whole website will work this way.
Huh, okay.
Right? So that's one thing. There's another thing, which is a browser extension, which you can install into your Chrome browser. And once you install it in your Chrome browser, it becomes a button on your browser. So no matter what page on the web, Wikipedia, Newslia, whatever, what website you go to, you can click that button, and then all the words on that page you're looking at will work this way.
So it just boggles my mind, really.
And then the third thing is we've built our own library, which has hundreds of stories for kindergarten, for preschool through adult, in which this technology and more technologies we don't really have time to talk about are built into.
But this is really important for parents who are looking for something to interest their child in learning to read. If you have a library of beginning readers, they could access those and introduce their child to the process.
Yep, they certainly can. And
that's awesome.
You know, coming all the way back, you know, the reason to do this is not whiz-bang technology. The reason to do this is archaic legacy technology in the form of 15th century static orthography. That's the reason we have these reading problems. So what we're talking about is upgrading the core technology of education to make it more learning friendly rather than trying to hold on to the way we did it in the 15th century.
David, when I was on your website, I came across a quote of yours, which I particularly like. I'm going to read it, and then perhaps you would expand it a little bit. I think you probably have in some of the things you've said, but I'd like to put it more in context. And the quote is, "Learning is the central dynamic of our health, our personal achievement, our relationships, jobs, economics, and politics. It is the core exercise through which our intelligences develop." I thought that was, I'd almost put that up in my room if I was still in a classroom. Can you really? It's a very powerful statement. Can you help to bring that more to a personal level with the mentors who are listening, whether they're teachers or parents or psychologists, psychiatrists, lawyers who are advocating for kids in the classroom? Can you help to tie some of those strings together for them?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's great. That's really nicely done. First of all, remember I said early on that our problems are all because of how we think about learning. And what you just said is how I think we should think about learning. We tend to think of learning as if it is an ancillary mental utility. It's one of the things we do. We go, we eat, we go to the bathroom, we walk, we talk, we learn. You know, it's like it's one of the things we do, rather than realizing it's at the center of all the things we do. It's not just something that happens in school. It's not just about knowledge. It's not just about skills. It's about how we relate to ourselves emotionally. There was no programming in us about how we were going to learn to deal with our anger, or how we were going to learn to eat healthily, or how we were going to learn to relate to our children, our loved ones, our spouses. All of that's learned. What's not learned? Nothing. There's right. Whatever is not learned, we couldn't say anything about without using what we've learned to describe it. Learning is at the center of everything. And until we care for learning with that kind of appreciation for its importance and its scope, our education and parenting efforts are misaligned, because we've compartmentalized it in too small and narrow a compartment. So learning is the central dynamic of being human. And in that sense, whether we're talking about the differentiation that an infant's doing to be able to connect with mom through words, or we're talking about the nth degree of imaginative extension into the physicist's conceptions of the universe, everything in between, emotional, cognitive, embodiment, everything involves learning.
That was beautiful. And I think it will help people who are listening to understand the importance of bringing their children to the learning process in a positive, nourishing their successes, and even praising their failures as a learning opportunity for them, because unfortunately...
As long as the praise isn't false, because kids can see through that. The one other thing I would add to this, that's probably the most important message for parents and teachers, is there's no substitute for your first-person learning. None. You cannot become a great parent or educator by following any model of how to do that. You can learn about a lot of models, but you have to differentiate them on the living edge of your learning to be a parent, your learning to be a teacher. Teaching and parenting needs to be learning-centric. You need to be ever better, ever more learning-oriented in how you are unfolding whatever you're unfolding for your children to learn. You have to meet them on the living edge of their learning. You have to model being a learner for them rather than being a knower, pusher of what to do.
David, I was going to ask you for some words of wisdom before we ended the podcast, and I think that was beautifully done. I want to thank you so much for all your time in preparing for this talk. I want to remind all of our mentors who are listening to go to learningstewards.org, and again, that's stewards with an X, to continue to probe into the amazing work that David has done. Go to
Children of the Code.
Children of the Code. Go to Children of the Code and listen, as I did, to several, if not more, of the videos that he has. They are so instructive. Thank you so much, David. I appreciate
your time. Thank you, Judith. I wish you all the best in your efforts. It's great. It's a great and important work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, mentors, for being with us today. If you found this podcast of value, please visit justeducationfirst.com to subscribe to our blog and Mentorship and Education podcast, so that you may continue the exploration with us. Our goal is to provide a free treasury of information for our listeners so they can become acquainted with the amazing resources that we have available to us. We want to thank all of our guests for giving their time and sharing their wealth of information with us. Please also visit their websites and explore more of their resources to further your pursuit of the topic. Hope to hear from you at justeducationfirst.com. Have a good week, and thank you.